feathers from his gorget.
"I have more important questions. The world you guarded was not unimportant. It should have been better protected. There should have been ships on response patrol. There should have been distress signals sent. Why was this not done?"
Dantine doesn't know, but Acharya hadn't known. He shrugs and shakes his head.
"We have analyzed your records," Vork says patiently. "There should have been naval support and regiments of your Astra Militarum on standby, and at the very last resort, you are under the protection of a chapter of Space Marines, are you not?"
There seems little point in denying that. Dantine finds he wants to talk, and that disgusts him. He had hoped to be so much stronger.
"The White Consuls," he says.
"The White Consuls," Vorks nods appreciatively. "A venerable name. Why are they not here?"
Dantine shakes his head again, miserably.
"Nothing works," he mutters. "The beacon's down. The astropaths are dead. The sky's bleeding."
Why did he use that word? That's not like him. He's a soldier, not a poet. Vorks nods, taking it all in.
"So, you are all blind now, just as the other one said. How interesting."
Dantine scowls.
"There'll be a response from someone. You'll be sent back to..."
He has no idea where these horrors have come from.
"To the Eye of Terror, Captain Dantine," Vork says. "You know that name, I assume. It has been our home for a long time, and not by choice."
He comes closer again, and the aroma of festering meat is hard to cope with.
"It was a prison, rooted into the fabric of reality. Breaking it open, it appears, has also broken everything else. Perhaps that was anticipated by those who did it. Perhaps not."
He sniffs.
"I find myself disappointed. We are cast adrift, and all has already been lain waste. I have my followers to think of. They are made for a life of conquest. If I cannot give it to them, they will find someone else who can."
Dantine cannot look away, even though he wants to. He feels sick again, as if his body has been scraped empty. He does not know what to say. He does not even know what to think.
"I am a great horror to you," Vork says.
That is certainly true.
"A long time ago," Vork says, "I was a horror to myself. The universe is full of horror. You can resist it and drive yourself into madness, or you can accept it and then begin to understand it. I would recommend the latter course, though I accept you must feel quite differently for now."
The conversational tone is absurd. Dantine has seen what these things do.
"Why did you come here?" he asks weakly, wishing he could think of something better to say, something more accusatory.
"We did not come here by choice. The warp's winds blew us here. Before reaching your world, we had no fixed point to guide us. Now we know where we are, to a degree, and can plan where to go next. It is the beginning of something unexpected."
Dantine tries to make himself angry. He tries to remember all those he saw being killed.
"Why?"
he asks feebly.
"Not for the reason you think."
Vorks lumbers off again. He seems to feel the need to keep moving, albeit in his stilted, stumbling manner.
There is a nobler way of living. We show this to the galaxy. We demonstrate it in our bodies, and we protect them from those who would harm it. We are the bringers of the gods' blessing.
Dantine stares at the monster. For a moment, he is entirely lost for words.
You killed them all.
I did not kill you.
Why?
I do not know. Ha! Do you believe that?
The monster muses.
I am a believer in fate. I recognize a conjunction when I see one. For what it is worth, that has kept me alive for longer than most, and I do not intend to turn an opportunity aside.
Why do you do it?
Dantine can feel himself losing control. He could become angry if he were not so worn out and nauseous.
You were a man once, were you not? You were a human?
I still am of a kind.
Vaux is not looking at him.
We are all on a spectrum, Captain. You are at one end, I am at the other. We are still the same species.
You are mad.
Vaux chuckles again.
I have lost count of how many times that insult has been aimed at me. By your kind, by my kind.
He is still pacing, as if counting out steps. There are things, sluggish things, that seem to be living in his armor.
The accusation is only meaningful if you can give me some suitable account of sanity. I saw the way you lived on that world. I have seen the way Imperial citizens live on 100 worlds. If you truly believe that this is a sane galaxy, and that we are the aberrations, then I pity you. But then, you have not seen all the alternatives yet. When you do, your mind may change.
Dantine tries to clench his fist. As the monster speaks, he attempts to gather the strength to lunge at him again. When he cannot do so, he slumps against the bench, defeated.
I wish to hurt you, he says mournfully.
Vaux stops pacing.
Of course you do. I do not blame you for that, but I cannot allow it. See, we have arts for this.
He reaches down to one of the many pouches at his belt. He rummages for a moment, and then draws out a thick bag, stained black from the liquids within. He moves closer to Dantine, opens the bag, and brings something out. For a moment, Dantine does not know what it is. Then he thinks it is meat, raw meat, offered as sustenance. Then he sees that it is a heart, blotchy with blood, and that it is still beating. The grisly spectacle makes him recoil until a greater horror dawns on him. His hands fly up to his chest, under the ripped jerkin of his uniform, and he feels the ridge of scar tissue there. Vaux puts the heart back in the bag and ties it to his belt again.
Your first lesson, he says. How are such things possible? They are not. In the only world you have ever known. But there is a greater one in which all things are made possible.
Dantine is hyperventilating. He cannot bear to touch the wound at his chest anymore. It makes him feel dizzy.
How did... he starts.
Hush, says Vaux,
holding a stumpy, calloused finger to his vox grill as he moves back to the door.
Enough for one day. You will need to rest if you are to be of service.
How am I alive?
Vaux looks at him.
Are you sure that you are, Captain?
He opens the door and steps across the threshold.
"You are insane!"
screeches Dantine, crawling after him. Then the door clangs closed, and ripples travel across the watery filth on the floor. Dantine is trembling. He draws in huge breaths, unable to understand how he is still able to do so. "It is a nightmare. I will wake from it soon." He tries to sing the words of the hymn, the one they recited on the barricade, to give him strength. But he cannot remember the words. He looks around, at the walls and the ceiling, at the rot and the slurry. He smells the decay, the dankness, and sees how complete his prison is. By the time he is screaming, the cell door is securely locked. Dantine's despair adds to the cacophony of voices already raised. Just one more addition to Solace's varied choir. It goes on for a long time, until unconsciousness takes him again, and the cell finally slinks back into its watery, torpid well of silence. 4. Eye's Edge. Chapter 9. There have been musters before, countless times, though it is hard to remember one of such dark magnificence. Some of the ships here gathered likewise at Beta Garmin, a god's lifetime ago. Some were constructed barely a century earlier, and their keels are still slick and free of the worst deep-stained void patina. The numbers are mind-bending. Ships have come out from every cranny and vault of I-space, dragging themselves from demon-hunted void docks and up from the lightless jails of asteroid-delved fortresses. There are sleek corvettes of the Emperor's children, shunned by all but their own kind, burnished in gold and chalcedony, and reeking of sadism. They go as proudly as they have ever done, though the old claim to primacy has been long lost amid their unique indulgences. Then come the renegade warbands, the motley barks looted from Imperial stations, each one bearing a different sigil in blood-red or ink-black. More have been spawned over the last millennium than ever before, and even the archivists of the Eye's sorcery-infested scriptoriums have long ago given up trying to catalogue them. They are hunted creatures, those renegades, always liable to be devoured by larger predators, and so they hang back within the less crowded void volumes, their weapons kept hot, and their engines fully primed. More stately craft arrive as the weeks go by, surging up from the warp-broiled depths in ancient and storied warships. The Thousand Suns answer the call, bringing with them pyramid-crested battlecruisers that still retain a certain aesthetic restraint. They are graceful things, those vessels, clean as jewels, pushing softly on blue-white plasma burners. There was once a time when the commitment of Magnus's sons might have been doubted, as well as their capability, but no longer. Prospero is not a word that haunts them any longer. Nor, for that matter, is Fenris. The gracefulness ends with them. Next to arrive are the flotillas from Perturabo's industrial soul forges, each one as grey as his heart and thick with venting filth. His dreadnoughts slide out of the warp, occluded in smog and wallowing heavily amid promethium discharges. Many of those craft are steeped in the demonic, having been fused and augmented over painful centuries within hammering hell foundries. Their blunt prows, blackened with the scorch marks of battle and never cleaned, jut aggressively in a pitiless display of military uniformity. Then come the lesser legions, in terms of numbers and coherence at least. The dusk-black killships of the Night Lords, drenched in projected terror, skulking like thieves on the margins. The Ophidian warcraft of the Alpha Legion, spreading out in variegated clusters, distrusted more than most, even among themselves, victims of a reputation they spun a long time ago and can now never escape. The World-Eaters, stragglers amid the coordination of the cohesive legions, their destroyers bearing the wounds of continual conflict, spattered arterial red. Fights break out, of course. Cruiser captains suddenly recognize the prow of a vessel they fought a decade before, or a navigation hail is misinterpreted as a challenge, or a demon trapped within a battleship's weapons grid bursts loose and sets itself to devouring. Flashes of cannon fire spot the entire muster sphere, breaking out at random and then dying away again as feuds are settled or greater powers intervene. As the gathering grows, these breakouts become more severe and more frequent, as if they were beasts clustered at a drying waterhole. There are battles in those weeks that in another time or place would be worthy of record. But here, among this outsize mustering, are merely pinpricks against a greater ground of conformity. This is the Despoiler's gift to the Eye's realm. There are feuds, and there are hatreds, but there is no greater feud than the one he perpetuates, and no greater hatred. He has bound them, impossibly, into common cause. Not since Horus himself, the great flatterer, the great master of soldiers' souls, has there been a figurehead so dominant and capable of command. He is not even here yet. The vengeful spirit will come to this place last, as is befitting. When all others are gathered, that ancient Gloriana Leviathan will make its entrance, forcing all to yield as it once did over the burning skies of terror. Until that moment, the new arrivals keep coming. The Word-Bearers, one of the three legions who have retained their old disciplines, take up positions near the center. Their battle fleets are marked with the bronze-hammered octet and bristle with the screams of the Neverborn. The greatest of those ships are floating cathedrals, stacked with impossibly lofty towers and parapets, and bursting with the gifts of the warp. Sacrificial fires burn along their lengths in defiance of physics, and their ranks shimmer with shifting, flickering witchlight. And then comes the greatest collection of all, the most varied and the most powerful by a distance, the hunt packs of the Black Legion, numerous beyond counting, drawn from every strain of chaotic allegiance and every vessel mark imaginable. There are corruption-steeped battlecruisers from the very dawn of the Imperial Age, ravaged by millennia of constant warfare, strutting proudly as preeminent slayers of the corpse-spawn's dreams. Here are new-founder designs, birthed from the shackled minds of savant shipwrights, freed from the strictures of standard templates and allowed free rein to create monstrosities of innovation. Here are gunbarks that strain with barely controlled energies. Here are personnel carriers with holds crammed full of Black Legionnaires. Here are transports that chain up titans and traitor knights, gifted by forge worlds of the Dark Mechanicum, and sent to war under the Black Legion's ubiquitous standard. Just as the Lunar Wolves were in the Age of Wonder, this Legion is now the first among equals, its mongrel bloodline the healthiest, and its clarity of loathing the purest. It has made no pacts, it has retained its soul, and now it swaggers through the Eye in an earned exhibition of dominance. The Death Guard are the very last to arrive in numbers. Just as it was so long ago, they turn up to bolster an already galaxy-ending display of power. Their living ships burst from the warp's grip like ejected spittle from a throat, straggling long lines of grimy matter, their grey-green marker-lights filmy and weak. These are some of the very oldest ships in the muster, eroded by the decay that blights all things under Mortarion's rule, but also engorged by it. The ships are paradoxes within a legion of endless paradoxes, the strongest and sickest, the most archaic and yet the most constantly renewed, the most uniform in their allegiance and yet the most variable in their outward aspect. They were the last to come under Abaddon's banner. They were the proudest, the ones who for the longest time maintained their own plans and powers. To see them here is the most striking mark of the Despoiler's grand vision, the final victory of his gathering in of the strays. The Death Guard do not mingle with those of other legions and warbands. Their presence is not welcome on the grand bridges of the fleet, for even the denizens of the Eye find their bodily corruption hard to stomach. They are, as they have ever been, an army apart. Dragon knows very little of this deep history. He does not appreciate study of the past, as Vorks does. His hinterland is sparse, a world of slaying motivated by current grudges and slights, rather than the elaborate interlinked vendettas of history. He looks out of the viewports of his shuttle and sees solace from the outside. It is black and brown, matted and congealed, a hunk of rotting vegetation hanging in the void. Its lights are dim, its mighty batteries almost obscured by blistered overhangs. It is hard to reconstruct what the ship must have been like at its birth. Dragon is no shipwright either, and so does not waste effort trying to imagine. Solace has been his home for almost 50 years, and yet it retains an alien quality. It may be that the ship's semi-dormant consciousness is deliberately repelling him. Still, he cannot fault its power. The wearing ages have made its bones strong, made its creaking weapons banks devastating, kept its engines stoked and thunderous. Solace will never be a nimble ship. It will never match the raw firepower of a full-line battleship, nor will it deliver the massive armies to war that a conveyor could. But it is a tough old creature, like leather boiled away for an eternity. He sits back in his seat. He should be on the ship now, preparing himself for the warp stage. Some of his brothers, Slurt in particular, are fizzing with excitement at what is to come. Even Philemon, that rot-headed old corpse hunter, is palpably stirred. Vaux, presumably, thinks Dragon is somewhere in the old practice cages, or hunting bilge filth for food, or doing something else on board, in secret. Solace is big enough that someone, even an unbroken, need have no difficulty keeping to oneself. He drums his armored fingers on his armored knee. He can see the shuttle's pilot up ahead, her body lost in a lattice of looped nutrient tubes. Like most pilots in the service of the Lords of Silence, this one is biologically part of the shuttle, limbs and torso fused into a ganglion of wires and pins. Her eyes are hidden by tubes leading to the external sensors, her fingers lost amid the twist and quiver of signal relays. He can see pox on the skin of her exposed neck, and it is advanced. She might last a few more years before either insanity or bodily collapse ends her. Then she will decay into the matter of the shuttle itself, forming a fertilizing lair for its next series of growths, and a nutrient-rich base for when Clado wires her successor into place. That is all part of the great arc of rebirth, the essence of the great creed, for those that care about such things. He looks back out of the viewport. The vista in all directions is crammed with starships. Even Dragon's wry soul is stirred a little by it. If you let your eyes lose focus for a moment, it seems as if the void has disappeared entirely, replaced by a plasma-like forest of overmingled thruster glow. He sees the one he is after. The pilot says nothing. She has no vocal cords, after all. But the shuttle swings upward towards its destination. Amid illustrious company, this one stands out. Even when set against deep-keeled monsters and storied warships from the dawn of recorded history, it still holds its own. It has perhaps the most malignant of all the profiles in that place, one twisted and altered to decomposing extremes by the power of the god. Were it not for the sorcery that pulses within its ancient heart, it would fall apart. Its antiquated spine is a study in corrosion, its bilges a vile melange of dissolved heavy metals and bubbling plague broth. From most angles, its precise dimensions are impossible to determine, for a cloud of warp flies obscures it for many kilometers out. Over the centuries, it has become a kind of permanent ward field, a thick layer of physically impossible insects zipping and droning across the void. As the shuttle reaches the outer skirts of the swarms, the tiny insects part to allow passage. If Dragon had not been a welcome guest, by now the small craft's exterior would have been chewed down to the engine lines. He watches as the maw of the intake hangar looms ever larger, a gaping hole in the rusting hull, outlined by long yellow teeth that protrude from iron rings. To be swallowed by it feels like being swallowed by a living thing. Presumably, of course, that is fairly close to the reality. A shadow falls over them. A crackle ripples along the shuttle's outer skin as the air gravity bubble slides across. They touch down on the deck within, and from outside, Dragon hears the clang of machinery, the bark of coarse speech, the long, echoing wind-down of the engines. For a moment, he sits, at rest. Then he is moving, stirring himself and heading down the long ramp into the gloomy interior. He is greeted at its base by members of the Traveller's own retinue, a mirror to the Death Shroud, armed with man-reapers and cloaked in silence. They say nothing to him, but beckon him deeper into the innards of the ship. It is humid and hot, and sunk into a heavy darkness that drips and lingers like bile. The Terminus Est is a big ship, and it takes them a long time to reach their destination. On the way, he witnesses similar scenes to those he left behind on Solus, gangs of Unbroken working on their weapons and their armor. They do not drill themselves in practice cages like other legions might. They do not engage in duels, nor do they make pilgrimage to an apostle to be screamed at. The sons of Mortarion prepare for war in seclusion, tending to the maladies that they cultivate within themselves. They discover what has changed in them since the last time they went to war, for there are always changes. They listen to the chatter of the little lords and the wandering plague-bearers, and attempt to divine a scamper of fate within the multitude of possibilities. It is all so quiet. The ship's beams creak, and the mighty engines growl, but the corridors are muted. There is no tense expectation of something immense to come, just a familiar, grim sense of resignation, of diligence. Dragon finds himself irritated by this. There are days when he wishes to shake his brothers, to stir up something within them. There is so little anger in this legion, despite it being set within a universe where the cause for it is so plentiful. In due course, his taciturn escort peels away, leaving him alone before a half-collapsed portal. The atmosphere is even hotter than before, and flies buzz everywhere, filling every gap, teetering on every surface. Some are fat blowflies, some are whining mosquitoes, and some are the swollen-bodied stingers of the destroyer hive. Some are real, some are the excrescences of the immaterium. As Dragon stands before the portal, they flock to him in clumps. They crawl over his armor. They burrow between the gaps. He feels them on his skin and resists the urge to flinch. Even the most unschooled of the Legion knows not to flinch. This is the first of Typhus's tests.
Come.
The voice is rotten, as grating as a rough saw's edge. It feels almost unsuited to this Legion, as if the speaker had been somehow wrongly placed. Perhaps he might have been happier among Angron's gladiators, or Perturabo's gloomy technicians of pain. In this, as in other things, Typhus is very much of his own species. Dragon ducks under the sagging lintel and enters warily. The chamber beyond is large, its roof soaring away into the darkness above. He finds it hard to make much out within, for the only lamps are dull and crawling with tiny black shapes. The floor was once marble, but has cracked and subsided, exposing what looks and smells like soil. The columns, thrusting high into the unseen heights, are running with teardrop lines of water, brackish and lumpy. For all the decrepitude, it feels like a wellspring here. It feels like something started on this spot a very long time ago. Typhus is waiting for him at the end of the long central hall. There is a throne carved out of pale stone, but he does not occupy it. Instead, he stands in the center of a wide circular platform, surrounded by his ever-thickening clouds of flies. When he moves, the flies swirl and solidify and form shapes in the air, all of which dissolve again like smoke. Typhus is like his flagship, a solid core around which only shadows spin. As Dragon comes closer, he sees enough to form an impression. He has caught glimpses of the Traveller before. He has even seen him fight from a distance. Up close, though, is a different proposition. All members of the Death Guard have a certain similarity of aspect, but Typhus is in many ways the archetype. Every trope and symbol employed by the servants of the plague finds its ultimate expression in him, for he was the one to introduce the vectors of change. All know this. All are aware of their legion's genesis, and yet none ever speak of it. What is there to say? The deed is done, and there is no going back.
"My lord, Typhus,"
Dragon says, dropping to one knee. Typhus stares at him for a moment, his tripartite cloven helm almost lost within the huge curve of his battle plate. Aside from a single upturned horn, the helm is white, as pale as moonlight on a grave, and the strange purity of it looks lost amid the extravagant degradation.
"Gallows, man," Typhus says. "I hear they call you that."
"Not a name I chose," says Dragon.
"Where did it come from, then?"
"I know not, lord."
Typhus grunts, and clouds of flies burst from his faceplate. He is constantly in motion, turning, twitching, dragging the hilt of his great scythe, as if the restlessness that provoked the great change has never settled down and continues to impel him.
"Your blood is thin," says Typhus.
It is a slur, that. A reference to the fact Dragon was not on Terra, and thus does not share in the honour of those who fought on the Corpse Emperor's own ground. Dragon has heard it many times, and it does not trouble him. Those of the old Legion can cling on to their failure as much as they like. It has always seemed to him a strange impulse to wallow in that infamous catastrophe, to harp on about it at every turn, to define every step forward in reference to that one colossal step into oblivion. Typhus moves again, lumbering around his low centre of gravity. The flies buzz, making the air shimmer with a wall of sound.
"Perhaps you do not even know why we call ourselves the Unbroken," he says.
"I know it," says Dragon.
"Tell me, then."
"We survived. We maintained discipline. We kept our ranks and our ships, and we lived to fight again."
Typhus laughs, and flies spill and tumble.
"Who told you that?"
"It is well known."
"It is horse shit."
Typhus turns back towards him, and tongues of steam slip across the marble.
"I was there when the words were first uttered. I stood with my battle brothers and first laid eyes on the Primarch."
The Primarch. Little enough reverence there.
"He was fresh from the surface," says Typhus, pacing. "There was still the poison mist curling from his robes. He was not even wearing armor. He was so thin. The Emperor stood by his side. The light from his armor was impossible to look at. What did we think? That the Primarch was a wretch? Something to be ashamed of?"
Typhus chuckles mordantly.
"But the Primarch had no doubts. He addressed us. He never raised his voice. He spoke as if he recognized every face in that audience, though most there were from Terra. It was the first and last time I heard him utter anything remotely affectionate."
Dragon listens. Typhus has an edge of scorn in his words, but it is hard to tell if that is simply the way he always speaks, or whether some special element of it is reserved for his master.
"He said that we were his unbroken blades. He said that we were his death guard. The Dusk Raiders were forgotten, leaving us with two new names. To the rest of the universe, we were indeed the Death Guard. Among ourselves,
We were the Unbroken. It hasn't changed. To those outside, we are terror. To those within, we are the Persistent.
Dragon does not know if he believes this story. It has the ring of something told and told again so many times that it generates an air of truth. Then again, Typhus has no reason to lie about it.
That is enlightening, Lord, he says. Why do I tell you this, you wonder?
Typhus asks.
For my education, as a thin blood.
The traveler fixes him with a rare, static glance. For a moment, the clouds of flies clear, and Dragon is staring straight into that terrible, horned face. The corruption in the white helm runs deeper than he has seen in any other. It looks like every scrap of armor is held together by something ephemeral, but also bone-strong. This is force of will, perhaps, or maybe just cheap magic.
I have heard stories of you, gallowsmen. We need fighters like you in this legion, ones with a sliver of anger still in them. That's the danger for those of us who have trodden the long path. We forget our fury. The god indulges us. The danger is in that.
Dragon finds himself nodding. He has thought similar things, often when confronted by one of Vorx's sermons.
We were the Unbroken,
Typhus says.
He never let us clean the filth from our armor. Over time, we stopped wanting to. We never turned away. It was a crooked road that took us to terror. But once we were there, we extracted our blood price. And now we return. No!
Typhus roars out the word, and the sound is like a blow. The cloud of flies bursts apart, as if hit by a shockwave, swirls angrily, then rapidly coalesces again.
No. For some reason, for some reason, that wisdom is not heeded. We have the chance now. The road is clear. We could do what we did 10 millennia ago and march with a new war master to the palace. The chance is there, hung before us, and our claws are across it.
Suddenly, Dragon knows what this is about.
Ultramar,
he ventures carefully.
Ultramar!
Typhus roars. Now the traveler is even more animated, stomping from side to side, gripping his scythe tightly, sending the clouds spilling and slewing around his every move.
Damned Ultramar! Too much was expended on that rabble of worlds before. Just when we have the chance to focus on the real prize, Ultramar rears up again. I despise it. I despise its master. I despise everything about it. And it is not important. Do you give a freshly squeezed shit about Ultramar, gallowsman?
Dragon suddenly finds he is enjoying this.
The orders are there,
he says.
And where do they come from? Why are they there?
Slowly, Typhus controls his anger. His movements become less jerky, more stately.
It can't be helped. I've spoken to the Primarch. I'll fight with him just as ordered. I'll be at his side, his faithful servant. But you know what this is about. His brother. I had thought that nonsense was all behind us. I had thought they were all dead or lost. The child kings were all gone. Speak to the despoiler, then speak to our Primarch, and tell me who you'd rather follow into battle.
This is lethal talk, or maybe madness. No one speaks of Mortarion in such a manner, certainly not within the Legion, and Dragon is strangely thrilled to hear it.
We will do these things,
Typhus says, growing sullen.
We will break the gate, and we will spill our poison across the living galaxy, and then we burn a path towards that pointless realm. None of this can be prevented. I am bound to the course now, both by oath and by fate. But you, gallowsman, you...
Dragon's eyes narrow. This is more temptation than he had expected.
We, too, are bound.
Typhus comes closer. The flies buzz and bump into Dragon. The aroma is like that of tombs, a tinge of sweetness over a musty hollowness.
I bent the laws of the universe to bring us to Terra once. I sacrificed my soul and those of my brothers, all for that goal. I did not do it so I could see us waste our strength on some family feuding. You understand me?
Dragon looks up at him. It is impossible to read the true intention on that ruined face. It is impossible to detect if Typhus is speaking seriously, or if this is just one more test. It is impossible to determine whether his own life is in mortal danger, or whether the laws of the Legion still apply in this place. So Dragon does not reply at once. He thinks of Solas and his fellow warriors. He thinks of Vorx and Garstag and Philemon. He thinks what would be required to alter a course already set, and how he might effect it. He thinks on the traveller's words, and remembers the injunction to fidelity.
You are my unbroken blades.
Then Dragon nods, curtly, as a soldier nods when accepting an order.
Perfectly, he says.
It takes weeks for the order to come in. Or perhaps days, or maybe months. It is always impossible to tell within the shifting temporal strata of the eye. Across whatever period of time elapses, there are plenty more firefights, boarding actions, scuttling actions, and withdrawals. Tension rises. The vast armies closeted tightly together within the thousands of holds teeter forever on the brink of explosion, as ready to turn on their own kind as the Imperials, if not held on the tightest of leashes. In the interim, pacts are reinforced, demonic allies are summoned or placated, old treaties are reaffirmed on the bridges of a dozen capital ships. Eventually, word begins to spread from ship to ship that the vengeful spirit has been spied entering the void volume, its guns run out and its engines burning star hot. Shutters are slammed down, engines are kindled and command stations hurriedly cleared. Warning klaxons bray out across the assembled formations, and prows swing heavily towards exit vectors. The void is unquiet in that time. Great swirls of null colour turn beneath the muster's heart, flickering with bale lightning along their flanks. The entire eye begins to pulse, riven with aurorae and eerie flashes of discoloration. Every mind starts to race, every heart starts to beat faster. The decks tremble under the massed tramp of armoured boots, and standards are hoisted in readiness for the deployments to come. Across the word-bearer's ships, dark apostles begin their orations, the pulpits wreathed in black-tipped flame. On the world-eaters' battle barges, the fight pits run with fresh blood as legionaries work themselves up into their full pitch of frenzy. As fractious as the muster has been, once the final order starts to flow down the intricate chains of uncertain command, all thought of internecine warfare is snuffed out. There are many stratagems used by the Despoiler to hold his disparate coalitions together, but the greatest incentive is, as it always has been, to show them the true enemy. Thrusters boom up to full power, and in that deep well of space it seems as if 1,000 new stars are born. Just then, just as the serried drivetrains boom into full-throated life, the flagship itself finally appears. Thrusting clear of its Black Legion escorts, emerging from an overlapping sensor shadow and into clear sight, like all such harbingers of the distant past, the vengeful spirit has, if anything, grown in sheer malevolence since its first incarnation as the fiefdom of the doomed Warmaster. The centuries spent in ice-space have blackened it, lengthened its spars, and warped its beams until it is cadaverous and rangy, a mass of ebon prows and barbed parapets. It glides like a shark of the lost oceans, supreme in its killing potential, unrivaled in that fleet or any other, a last dark reminder of the genius of Crusade-era humanity. Once it begins to move, all others fall in behind it. The entire massed fleet, one ship after the other, powers up to cruising speed. The escort-class ships spread out to the margins, leaving the Leviathans to take up position at the center. It takes many hours for the vanguard to process from the muster sphere, and many more hours for those behind to fall in. Such is the concentration of the demonic on those ships, bound by chains or spells, that the warp itself flexes and ripples, caught in sympathetic vortices across the scant protection of straining Geller fields. The skein of real space, already strained, buckles, throwing scatter patterns of distortion racing like tsunamis across a turbulent seascape. Vox silence descends, and the cavalcade makes its way in eerie quietness out to the staging grounds, where the first squalls of the borderlands begin to roil and churn. Arcs of witchlight crackle and snap, fueled by the tectonic clash of realities. All ship captains have braved those shoals before and know the dangers. Many ships will be lost on the crossing, even if the gods smile on this endeavour. Such is the caprice of the Eye's Edge. The vengeful spirit does not slow. As the Behemoth forges ahead, spectral lights, grey as ghosts, ripple into gauzy existence alongside it. In snatches, caught from the corner of an eye, it looks as if there might be more ships out there, riding the riptides with contemptuous ease. The ghosts force a path, their marker lights glowing like ships' lanterns from the age of earthbound sail. The void shudders, flexes, and begins to break. Rifts tear across it, exposing a lattice of strobing witchlight below. Some rifts explode into whirling vortices, spinning out of control. Others flicker into darkness the second they are born. Many more implode, dragging the fragile materium down into gaping abysses. The wells extend, burrowing like cancers into the foundations of the universe, and soon 1,000 tunnels are bored between worlds. Storms grow, squalls lash, and one by one the battleships pass into the flickering jaws of the winding warpways. This is the realm where the physical meets the metaphysical. This is the place where madness crashes up against the static kind of sanity, where the laws of physics are sucked away and dribble into their weakened twilight state. Every ship creaks and clangs. Every shield generator flares and crackles. Geller fields scream, and the background howl of ravening Neverborn becomes ear-splitting. Solace thunders along with the rest of them, caught up in a barreling momentum now, and unable to stop. There are other ships on all sides, hemming themselves in, locking the Death Guard contingent into a procession of steadily increasing speed. Chronometers, all of them with mouldering faces and rusting hands, spin around in a frenzy, clattering and clicking as the numbers rack up crazily. The ship skids, as if it has thumped into something solid. Old power lines blow, and the lumens sway on their supports, making the shadows leap and tremble. For a moment, it seems as if the engines will overload entirely, racked by faltering intakes and buffeted by the hammering gale of the immaterium. A whine breaks out, gets louder, then louder again, until it is almost unbearable. The unbroken stand at their stations, enduring it, while servitors and unchanged crew succumb to the dreadful pressure, clamping hands over their bloody ears. Armor glass shatters, decks crack, bracings crumple. Then, after what could have been hours or days or even longer, the pressure suddenly splinters into nothing. The riot of color, the spectrum of the eye's unquiet heart, is shredded away and replaced with a tapestry of pure black, speckled with the light of real stars. The howls die away, the clangs echo into oblivion. Ships shoot out into the materium, their prows glowing as if fresh from the foundry's fires, their engines cycling wildly. It takes a moment for the navigators to truly realize what they have done. Inter-ship reports begin to crackle into vox stations, a guttural mix of 1,000 eyeborn tongues and hailing standards. Some report losses, or catastrophes, or sightings of incredible creatures lost far in the hidden depths. But the fleet is intact, still immense beyond comprehension, and more ships are bursting into instantiation every second. The vengeful spirit is powering ahead, carving through the void with its coterie of killers in tow. Solace, like all the rest, follows suit, now turning its attention to its gunnery crews and drop-pod hangars. For the focus of their endeavours can now be seen, blearily, on the extreme forward augers. Across a million pictoscreens, it glimmers in soft focus, fractured by distance. On either flank, the virulent stains of ice space still linger, but the ships are travelling down the clear channel now, racing across space that offers them no impediment. And before them, isolated and embattled, a single point of light amid a galaxy of darkness, stands the object of their fury. Cadia stands. For now. Five. The Weeping Veil. Chapter 10. Dantine returns to Najan. He does not understand where these orders come from, nor why he is incapable of resisting them, but he does so anyway, mutely, weakly. He is sick. He lifts his hands and sees the pox and the wheals on them. His skin has become sallow, even more so than it was when he worked on the surface. There is a growth on his stomach, hard as a stone. He can push it around under the skin. And then there's the wound on his chest. A while back, he dared to lift his filthy jerkin and undershirt and look at it. The flesh was angry, stitched closed with thick, inexpert sutures. A little pus leaked from it. It looked like the kind of infection a guardsman would die from, were it left untreated. The least experienced trooper under his old command could have performed more capable battlefield surgery. He has not looked at it since. He can leave his undershirt in place now, since he does not wash. There are no facilities on the ship, and in any case, he has lost the desire to. He no longer pays attention to his hair, which is running with biting lice. He lets his nails grow. For his entire life, Dantine's personal habits have been fastidious. His regiments were always well run, with regular hygiene drills and dorm unit inspections. There were times when this seemed almost obsessive, as if the Departamento's rules had become a part of the state religion that governed every other part of life. Those rules were a protection, though. Disease was always a big killer in the Astra Militarum, and efforts to stave it off were unrelenting for a reason. Now, he does not care. Mostly, this lassitude appalls him. He cannot understand why he no longer cares. But deep down, buried where his old heart once beat, there is something else. Something infinitely shameful, so that he does not think of it often, and pretends that it is just another part of his sickness. But it is there, all the same. Relief. He no longer has to make the effort, and that is a pleasure in itself. It is like falling asleep, or sinking into a warm pool of water. He lets it all slide, all degrade. He can feel his muscles atrophy, and does not intervene. He can feel his bowels swell with inflammation, and it matters not. This is a kind of release. This is like a fist clenched for a lifetime, slowly relaxing. But he resists it when he can. He continues to remember himself. He looks around at the grimy walls and the filthy decks, and feels like screaming again. They let him walk throughout the ship unhindered, knowing that he will not try to escape. He does not go far. The noises from the levels below continue to fill him with dread, and he encounters enough on his own deck to make him gag. The smell is just as it was on Najan once the monsters broke into the compound, only intensified. The ship is stained hard with it, from every rivet and bulkhead to every lumen and plate bolt. The air is oversweet. The corridors are dark and hemmed in. At times, he imagines he has been swallowed by this place and is being slowly digested. At times, he feels as if the ship is a stomach, moist with juices and ripe to contract around him. At times, he feels as if the ship is alive. But then they tell him to go to Najan again. Numbly, he traces the route towards the shuttle bays. He knows the way well enough, although no one has ever explained it to him, and he has never stumbled across the hangars before. He passes other menials on the way and avoids eye contact. This is easy with many of them. Their eyes are long gone. But he is aware that others stare at him. Perhaps he looks like an enemy. Or maybe they stare at everything, their minds turned to porridge by the stink and the dark and the noise. He is greeted at the open door of the shuttle by a human pilot. She is fat and slovenly, her face hidden behind a rusty metal plate, and her hands replaced with input jacks. She says nothing, but clambers into the cockpit. Tendrils extend from the front panels, and she grunts as they slot in. Dantin hauls himself into the crew section. He looks at the restraint harnesses hanging from the roof like sides of meat. He should put them on. He doesn't. What's the point? What's the point of anything? It takes a long time to get drop clearance. Dantin listens to the muffled vox traffic. To him, it sounds like snarls and growls. He closes his eyes. Eventually the deck rattles and the engines cough into intermittent life. The transfer to the surface is bumpy and slow. He looks out of the viewports until they are doused in re-entry flame. After that, they give him a view of Najan's desolate surface. The world is brown-grey, almost featureless. He can see orderly swirls of cloud passing below, the product of the operative weather system. It looks just as it did when he first arrived, a long time ago. That memory makes him feel instantly nauseous, so he closes it down. He sits back, his fingers gripping the vibrating bench, and grits his teeth. He tries to remember the words to the old drill manuals, and finds that he can't. He tries again. The shuttle hits the ground with a thud. When the doors open, dusty wind shrieks inside, making him blink and spit. Dantin stumbles out and down the ramp, wiping at his eyes. There are menials everywhere. They are all terribly ill, with bloody bandages around their foreheads and sore-crusted hands clutching at rags. He does not recognize any faces, and so assumes that these are crew brought down from the monster's ship. He sees some of the old duty servitors in the distance, limping on too many legs or dragging a half-body along with too many arms. Najan is beginning to smell bad. It is beginning to fester. The wind is no longer dry, but feels like a canine's breath washing over the fields. The colours, such as they are, have all gone. Dantin's vision is a mess of greys now, a bank of fog that he peers through. Has the world changed? Or has he changed? He walks towards his old barracks. The gates are still broken, and the walls are crumbling and charred. In the grey light of day, the damage looks even worse than before. They demolished the entire place, just a handful of them. The unbroken have congregated in the old parade ground, and now stand like monoliths amid the wreckage. Their leader, the one called Vaux, who seems to have taken Dantine under his wing, is there, as are the others. Dantine knows their names now. Slurt, the one with eyes under his skin. Clado, the one whose soul has withered. Garstag, the slayer. Philemon, the corpse counter. Dragan, the warrior, hangs back on the edges,